It's traditional, of course, at dinner time to maybe make a few light remarks. Now, I saw the way that Hadley Arkus could do this, and he would have you all rolling. But I don't have his skills, but I can quote him, so if you can't beat them, quote them. He said, for example, on Professor George, it was a remarkable thing for him to get tenure when he had done nothing to disguise his views. After all, it was quite risky for the politics department to give tenure to a strong, attractive young conservative in a department of only 50 people. Why, as the saying goes, he could just unbalance the whole place. I also thought that being here, I would let you have a bit of evening entertainment for just a couple of minutes, about 120 seconds worth. Could we please start that, Leland?
Gone right, I mean,
on that southbound pasture train.
You don't recognize this. This is Professor George's band.
I'm gonna ride with him singing, of course.
Gone right, I mean, on that southbound pasture train until I hear that old conductor say,
all out
for Birmingham.
Pancho was a bandit boy.
As I said, 120 seconds.
Horse was fast as polished steel. He wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. But Pancho met his match, you know, on the deserts down in Mexico. No one heard his dying words. Ah, but that's the way it goes. I'm going back to old Virginia, where the mountains are so high. Among those hills, I learned to love you. I'm gonna stay there till I die.
He tells me that, I read at least in an interview that he gave, that he actually played bluegrass at New College, Oxford, so a 14th century college at Oxford, and I just tried to picture the bluegrass going across the quadrangle. So here you've got it, and I think it's even more appropriate, obviously, in Tennessee.
Lay me down, Carolina, lay me down. Don't want to wake up in the morning no more. Sing me one so sad song for this one last old time before they close the minstrel show.
Ran into the devil and he loaned me 20 bills. Spent the night in Utah in a cave up in the hill.
Start up, but I'm taking my time. Friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight. I just might get some sleep tonight. Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord.
So that's the final song, and I thought that it would be appropriate. That song, as you well know, is about a mother's death, but I thought that it could also remind us of the speaker who isn't present here this evening, but whom we all had hoped would be able to be here, and that, of course, is the late Richard John Neuhaus. Robert P. George said in an interview given this past January, quote, "Like all who enjoyed the extraordinary blessing of his friendship, I already miss him terribly. A great hole has been created in our lives and nothing can fill it. I miss his sparkling conversation, his amusing stories, his witty riposts, his volcanic, booming laugh. I miss his words of encouragement and his inspiring and sometimes even exhilarating call to arms on behalf of the great moral causes of our day. I miss jousting with him about ideas. Like all of his spiritual children, I am feeling orphaned." I thought about that word, that idea of feeling orphaned, and it brought me back then to the song that you just heard Professor George's band perform, and I thought it would be appropriate to adapt the words of one of the stanzas to remember Father Neuhaus by. I only apologize that I can't recite it with the feelings that I've heard it performed when I've heard the Nitty Gritty Band perform it or Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan perform it. The stanza is this. I said to the undertaker, "Undertaker, please drive slow. for that body you are carrying, Lord, we hate to see him go. Will the circle be unbroken? By and by, Lord, by and by. There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky. So I'm sure that we all miss him, and I appreciate that you are having someone that probably could say a lot more about him at this podium than I could. So I apologize about that. But I'm delighted to be here at Union University, and I want to thank President Dockery for organizing this and for letting us be here. Since I had dinner here at the table with the president, I learned that at 3 p.m. this afternoon, he became a grandfather for the first time. Abigail Catherine, is that right? So congratulations, sir. Perhaps that's something of this circle, that as great spirits go, great spirits also, of course, join us. Thank you as well to Provost Carla Sanderson and Dean Jean Fant, the Dean of Arts and Sciences, as well as I'm very honored that the Charles Colson Professor is here, Hal Poe. Obviously, the reason why we're gathered here is to revisit the central tenets of Professor George's Making Men Moral. I've got the soft back here. A very worthy purpose for a conference. My aim, however, is slightly different. I've been invited to place some of Professor George's central arguments in Making Men Moral, published in 1993, into the context of the body of his work, both as a scholar and as a public intellectual. This afforded me the pleasure of reading thousands of pages of his published work in a relatively short time. So it forced me to do it systematically. For a historian, an intellectual historian as I am, this is very important. You want to be able to get some kind of an arc of someone's life to see what kinds of contributions they make. Quentin Skinner at Cambridge suggests that we even look in places that we normally wouldn't look at, so not only the great works, but also other things that the person produced. Skinner's thesis is that you can actually learn more about the insights, particularly as somebody addresses a broader public, where they're forced to condense and be very succinct with thoughts. So this isn't going to be only about what he's produced as far as books and scholarly articles, but also his attempts to address the broader public. Making Men Moral was reviewed in all of the prestigious scholarly journals when it was published. Just a few, for example, the Harvard Law Review, the American Political Science Review, Ethics, the Journal of Law and Religion. Now, if you just take those four, and it was reviewed in many more, these could be seen to represent the four areas of Professor George's scholarly work: law, ethics, religion, and politics. These areas are also reflected in his formal scholarly degrees, so a PhD with an emphasis in legal philosophy from Oxford, a law degree from Harvard Law, a master's in theological studies from the Divinity School at Harvard, and a BA from Swarthmore. So Making Men Moral, I would argue, is something of a microcosm, although it is certainly not exhaustive, of Professor George's thinking in these four areas. I was also struck that in it was an announcement that there would be further scholarship to follow. One always expects that, of course, of a scholar, but he actually puts that into one of the chapters and says, I'm arguing from principle here, and I will give you further applications of these principles later. So in a way, you could say it was at least a two-book project, the first book coming out in 1993, and the promise of follow-up to actually continue to prove the point and evince what he was arguing. So the project was conceived as long-term and expansive, I think, from the very start. I've also wondered, as I've reviewed the body of Professor George's work, what was going through his head as he read, discussed, and thought in the 14th century New College of St. Mary, where this work was largely written at Oxford. The connections between the material of the book, the central tradition he establishes as a foundation to natural law theory, and the physical setting must have surely crossed his mind, as also must the impact of the Enlightenment that changed the nature and purpose of the very setting in which he was writing. So there was both architectonic kind of continuity, but also change within. And I think somehow his book addresses this as well. Given the constraints of time, I can provide here only a sketch of some of his most prominent ideas and cannot review each of his 14 edited and co-edited volumes and monographs, nor all of his 80 scholarly articles, not counting book reviews. Also, he has about 200 contributions to popular media fora such as the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the National Review, the Weekly Standard, First Things, Touchstone. By last count, and I received a curriculum vitae that was about probably a year out of date, I noticed that he'd been invited to speak in about 100 different settings, which don't include actual conference papers, so not just conferences, but individual with him as a featured speaker. He's also got, of course, appearances on the BBC, the ABC, CBS, NBC, NPR, PBS, Fox, CNN, Voice of America, C-SPAN, etc. So I can only really give you a selective sampling here, and of course encourage you, as any historian would, to go to the primary sources yourself, look at the works. The conference, of course, is meant to wrestle, and I take that from the advertising poster, with ideas about how to promote a healthy moral ecology. Therefore, as I provide you with this analytical sketch, I'll also ask some questions of the work on occasion, sometimes from what I believe to be fair-minded reviewers of critics, but also, of course, from those who collaborate and who are friendly and sympathetic to the work. In Making Men Moral, Professor George makes the case that although laws are not in themselves sufficient to establish and maintain a healthy moral ecology, they help to limit what he calls powerfully seductive vices in the moral environment of the community, and public morality upholds and reinforces the teachings of the persons and institutions, such as parents, teachers, and religious leaders, who have the primary role in the character formation of the next generation, and indeed of each new generation. So I wanted to, as you're going to hear some deeper analyses of Making Men Moral and some of its tenets later on, just summarize a few of the points, and then show you how these concerns have followed Professor George, or indeed been guided by him, through his life in his various works. So one of his central, truly, I think, major intellectual concerns has been the critique of liberalism. That's, of course, a difficult term to define, and he makes sure to avoid the trap of amalgamating all liberalisms into one. He doesn't say, here's what liberalism is, and let's now attack this or critique it. He instead critiques individual liberal ideologies as articulated by some of the leading liberal theorists. I thought, however, that it would be helpful to at least give you perhaps one definition, at least by analogy, of what liberalism could be taken to mean. I noticed in this month's, for example, First Things, George Weigel argues that the word narrative has come to dominate our political rhetoric. This postmodern conflict, Weigel argues, reflects a cast of mind in which human beings have no secure grasp of the truth of things, be that historical truth or moral truth. There is only your truth and my truth, which is to say, you've got your story and I've got my story. Narrative is all, and narrative has no tether to an objective truth of things that we can know by the exercise of reason, according to Weigel. This epistemological skepticism infuses even liberalism's most thoughtful proponents, including Professor George's old boss, Professor Harold T. Shapiro, who was president of Princeton University, and wrote the following, quote, "The challenge we now face is deciding how to adapt our current narratives regarding the meaning of human existence in light of our new understanding and scientific knowledge of both the natural world and our evolving concepts of human nature. Where will we find the basis for a new narrative and a new morality to support it?" So the idea that we simply create these new narratives because our nature isn't stable and we don't have access to anything like the truth. I think this is the kind of liberalism, generally speaking, that Professor George critiques. Obviously, he critiques legal theorists such as H.L.A. Hart, Ronald Dvorkin, John Rawls, Jeremy Waldron, David Richards, and Joseph Raz. In the Harvard Law Review, Professor George gave an example that I have no doubt that most of us in this room tonight will recognize, so in something that he contributed to the Law Review that was published, and I quote him now. "Anyone who has ever attended a cocktail party or taught a college course in ethics or political theory is likely to be familiar with the following line of argument. People in our society disagree about the morality of, for example, abortion, pornography, or homosexual conduct. The fact of moral disagreement shows that there is no objective moral truth about these matters." Remember, he's, of course, putting us in the mindset of this. He's not actually arguing this. There is merely subjective moral opinions on those who happen not to share them. Therefore, laws prohibiting, discouraging, or even disfavoring abortion, pornography, or homosexual acts unjustifiably violate people's freedom. That tends to be a typical argument. Think of a classroom setting in which you're in. Oh, we disagree about the subject. There's no way to get at whether something is true or not true, or to critique these differing views. I was reminded of the hold of this line of thinking only about a week ago in preparation for this conference when I went to have my haircut. During the course of my visit, I was asked politely what this conference was about. When I reviewed briefly the arguments in making men moral, the person who was trying to help me, a woman, said that although she disagreed with pornography, it was all right for others to view pornography as long as the viewing of pornography did not hurt anyone else. A typical, I think, response. However, you can imagine my surprise when I learned, in fact, my shock, when she noted that pornography had played the major role in ending her relationship with a boyfriend. When I pointed out that she had indeed been hurt by pornography, she readily agreed, and then added that she felt that it was also degrading to women and that it even hurt the men who viewed pornography. She also did not want pornography sold at her local store. Yet, despite wanting to keep her moral environment unpolluted, she found it difficult to have the confidence in the view that legislation curbing pornography was somehow right or fair. It was, as Professor George wrote in this Harvard Law Review, an example of, quote, an illicit inference of an absence of objective moral truth from the existence of moral disagreement. Having reviewed his work, you'll find that he argues very densely. Each word has a nuance and meaning. Let me just repeat that half a sentence because there's much in that. An illicit inference of an absence of objective moral truth from the existence of moral disagreement. His political philosophy is premised, I believe, as have reviewers suggested, on the conclusions of normative ethics. Political philosophy on this view should begin by determining what classes of acts are right or wrong and in what a good life consists. Can the state respect freedom of speech, press, assembly, privacy, religion, which are all intrinsic goods, as well as to some degree instrumental goods, and act legitimately to, quote, serve a moral climate in which citizens live, even if the latter requires legislation that criminalizes certain, quote unquote, victimless actions? Liberal freedoms themselves only make sense against the background of a theory of the human good, and thus offers a perfectionist account of civil liberties, from a reviewer. Legislating does not make men moral, but it dissuades people from pursuing grosser forms of vice. One of the questions that is asked in Making Men Moral is, what is the good life for a community and how is it promoted? And he argues this through something known as the central tradition. We'll hear more about that, I'm sure, from Professor Stoner, as well as critiquing modern interpretations of this tradition. He also critiques, as I've mentioned, some of the liberal theorists who would argue a pluralism, let's say, of values that wouldn't allow judgment to occur. In fact, he helps us to understand how judgment can happen through reason. I've been surprised at some of the reviews that I read that were contemporaneous to the publication of the book, including from the aforementioned Harvard Law Review. I wondered, as a novice, in a sense being myself baptized into the understanding of some of these things in political philosophy, how someone could have read the book and then asked the question, for example, that where is Professor George's definition of the good, when much of the book is dedicated to just that, to showing the variegated and diversity of human goods. For example, the fulfillment and well-being of all persons as a good, marriage, friendship, living in harmony with others, religion, all very plainly stated. So I was stunned. Some reviewers, though, I think asked some interesting questions that could be insightful. Mary Keyes, professor of political science at Notre Dame, wondered if there wasn't something that couldn't be seen in Aquinas's positive pedagogy, which might welcome the legally sanctioned, for example, holiday of Thanksgiving, allowing many disparate groups in America to indeed give thanks, but in their own way, according to their own customs. She felt that in some of Professor George's writings, the blunt instrument of the law was seen as something only coercive instead of something that might produce results in a maybe more widely accepted positive view. One critic, however, I think tellingly pointed out that the title of the book, Making Men Moral, might be seen as triply offensive by some on the lookout for non-inclusive language, men, and of course anything that smacks of legislating morals, making moral. But the reviewer concluded the book is judicious and scrupulously avoids rhetorical excesses in favor of considered judgment. The author, we are told, challenges much that is axiomatic in contemporary political philosophy, yet he is consistently respectful of his opponents and careful in his attempts to present their arguments. This, I would say, is a trademark of the way that Professor Robert George argues. This reciprocity continues throughout all of his work. Robert George respects the work of others, but also insists that the respect upon which reciprocity rests is informed by the arguments that we make, particularly if we occupy a position of acceptance in society, if our positions are the dominant ones. Natural law theory, of course, buttresses making men moral, and it is in this realm that Professor George has most profoundly made his scholarly contributions. He's defined natural law as, quote, the body of moral norms and other practical principles which provide reasons, including moral reasons, for action and restraint, unquote. This challenges, among other things, the skeptical philosophy of David Hume, which, quote, rules out the possibility of a natural moral law. Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and may pretend to no office other than to serve and obey them. George continues, on the Humean account, people can reason about how to get what they want, but not ultimately about what to want. According to Humeans, the reason people have for the choices they make and the actions they perform are exclusively instrumental reasons. They are intelligible purely as means to ends given ultimately by desire. Reason cannot identify certain ends as intrinsically valuable, desirable, and thus choice-worthy. Natural Law, Liberalism, and Morality, a book published by Oxford University Press that Professor George edited, came out 3 years after Making Men Moral. An edited volume, as some of you will well know, is a strange bird among scholars, and it is increasingly difficult to get university presses interested in actually publishing edited volumes. Why? Because it's very difficult for an editor to achieve coherence with an edited volume, to focus a volume on a particular subject, and at the same time to expect fresh work of a high scholarly standard. I think it would be fair to suggest that maybe some of you had experienced going to the library, taking an edited volume, and needing one single article from it, maybe not looking at anything else that's there, a typical way to use such a volume. Therefore, I thought this Natural Law, Liberalism, and Morality was remarkable, not only, of course, for the content, but for the way the actual volume was shaped. It shows an intellectual shaping, an ability to contribute, to make a contribution to scholarship, and indeed to shape the scholarship itself by the volume. So over 300 pages are spread 14 original chapters, each written by a well-known scholar of natural law or liberalism. It sets a high standard for the way a scholarly volume can be composed. It is also a model of Professor George's preferred method, the dialectic, featuring sharply differing perspectives. Throughout the book, scholars are responding to each other's interpretations. So for example, Stephen Macedo responds to John Finnis, Jeffrey Ryman to Michael Zuckert, Christopher Wolfe to Joseph Raz, Daniel Robinson to Lloyd Weinreb. So you've got a dialectic occurring even as you're reading the book. Very valuable. 3 years later, Oxford University Press would publish In Defense of Natural Law, so 1999. This was the fulfillment of the promise made in Making Men Moral to move from the level of principle to specific applications. The book is divided into three parts, which respectively address, first, the critics of the new natural law philosophy, as some of those critics call it, applying natural law theory to moral, social, and political issues, and thirdly, to address moral, legal, and political philosophers, contemporary ones. You could call this, I would, in my view, the second monograph. These articles had appeared in the top-notch legal journals in the country, but as was promised in Making Men Moral, it was programmatic. They were to tackle and apply these principles that were given in Making Men Moral to actual situations, and this is where you get the culmination of that promise. The book was preceded by Natural Law and Moral Inquiry, 1998, that Professor George edited for Professor Germaine Griset, whom he has expressed his debt to on many, many occasions. But in no way was it merely a celebratory collection, as included amongst the admirers of his work are those who have also argued against the positions laid out by Professor Griset. In 2003, Professor George edited another important volume of the kind that students would wish we had more. Natural Law appeared in the second series of the International Library of Essays in Law and Legal Theory. A historian would call this a historiographical volume, that is, a set of significant previously published essays, so not Professor George's, but others, given in full that highlight for a student essays of central importance in that particular area, organized thematically as well as chronologically. These are invaluable volumes when you can find them. Now, Professor Finnis had put out, I believe, two volumes previous to this, so Professor George was in a very advantageous position to be able to focus very, very clearly in this type of volume. And when you can get them, they're like gold dust. As one may plainly see, since the publication of Making Men Moral, Professor George has continued to refine, renew, and reload natural law theory for the next generation of scholars. This has become a foundational element of his teaching, both at Princeton and at other places. At Princeton, if you were to get your hands on his spring 2006 course packet for the philosophy of law, Politics 563, which I was able to obtain, you would see that many of the texts, but by no means all, give students the opportunity to examine natural law theory in discussion with liberalism, as well as with legal positivism, another one of the areas that Professor George has critiqued, particularly in the writings of the 19th century Oliver Wendell Holmes, most recently at Harvard's Dewey Lectures. Professor George works hard to allow students outside of Princeton to take advantage of an opportunity to learn about his views. For example, a year before that Princeton course was on offer, qualified students from across the United States could have attended a first principles seminar on, quote, the application of natural law thinking to present-day situations at the Witherspoon Institute in Princeton, an independent research center where Professor George is director of the program in political thought and constitutional government. Professor George also helps students to use their reason, what pedagogues might call critical thinking, in evaluating complex questions in, for example, politics. Here, for example, are two former students, Ryan Anderson and Sharif Gingras, each a graduate of only a couple of years, evaluating the very recent recommendations of Jonathan Rauch and David Blankenhorn, just published recently in the New York Times. Here, these two students give their response. I'm not going to, of course, quote it at length, but listen to this single paragraph. As we see it, say Anderson and Gingras, this proposal grants too much to revisionists and too little to traditionalists. Revisionists get the substantive, if not linguistic, treatment of homosexual unions as marriages. Traditionalists get conscience protection of unspecified scope. But traditionalists' primary concern is not simply to secure an enclave of personal liberty to regard marriage as they see fit. Rather, it is to promote a healthy culture of marriage understood as a public good that also fulfills spouses and the larger communities of which they are members. They go on to adumbrate how these public goods, what these public goods are, and how in their reasoning, the compromise that Blankenhorn and Rauch put forward fails to be a viable compromise. Can you see here the logic and reasoning of Making Men Moral? Not the parroting of positions, but the application of method being applied by a rising generation of young people who have been taught to think logically and be respectful and serious when critiquing ideas in the public square. I had the opportunity when I was a Madison Fellow to sit in on some of Professor George's venerable constitutional interpretation classes. He uses a text published by Princeton University Press with leading scholars that you'll hear from at this conference, such as Hadley Arkus and Jean Bethke Elstein. And in this, it's also, in this class, it is also a Socratic method. This isn't a class driven by conservative or liberal ideology. It's driven by the search for truth and through the dialectic to achieve that. This method was writ large in a freshman seminar Professor George co-taught 2 years ago with Cornel West, a Princeton colleague and a friend. They have, in the words of Professor West, a professor of religion at Princeton, strong ideological differences. To wit, during that semester, Professor George was invited to see the Pope in the Vatican, and Professor West was invited to Venezuela to see President Hugo Chavez. But But this kind of a course represents what I would call the RPG, maybe rocket-propelled grenade teaching style, the Robert P. George pedagogical style at its best, reasoned argument with a fair-minded opponent. Thus, his students have a model with which to do this themselves. In another contribution to campus life, he advises students who organize themselves in the Anscombe Society, named after the well-known philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe. She herself, of course, a student of Ludwig Wittgenstein. She was elected the professor of philosophy at Cambridge. She was a wife and mother of 7 children. As this student society might be of interest to university administrators and officials here this evening, let me just read to you the paragraph that they put on their website. The Anscombe Society is a student organization at Princeton University dedicated to affirming the importance of the family, marriage, and a proper understanding for the role of sex and sexuality. We aim to promote an environment that values the crucial role the intact, stable family plays in sustaining society. The definition of marriage as the exclusive, monogamous union of a man and a woman, its role as an institution which is necessary for the healthy family, and thus for a healthy society, a conception of feminism that encourages motherhood, and a chaste lifestyle which respects and appreciates human sexuality, relationships, and dignity. Therefore, we celebrate sex as unifying, beautiful, and joyful when shared in its proper context, that of marriage between a man and a woman. The society provides, now my words, an environment where students who share similar moral values may socialize and find a haven from the campus hookup culture. Associated as they are able to work with the campus administration for fairness in, for example, exposing freshmen during mandatory or compulsory orientation to a sexual morality that includes a chaste lifestyle. They invite speakers to campus, such as UCLA student psychiatrist Miriam Grossman, to share their research and insights. One of Professor George's deepest concerns for the state of American universities is that freshman orientation, and in particular, such compulsory events during that orientation are, quote, calculated to undermine any lingering traditional beliefs about sexual morality. Dissenting views to campus orthodoxy, such as the view that sodomy and promiscuity are immoral and affronts to human dignity, are never aired. The manifest point is to send the clearest possible message to students who may dissent that they are outsiders who had better conform or keep their mouths shut, unquote. Here's one example of the kind of impact that Professor George's writings have. This is a student who didn't know him previously, a student at the University of Chicago who wrote the following to Professor George after reading one of his articles, quote, I want to express my profound gratitude to you for your courageous scholarship on the issue of marriage. I was recently sent your article, What Sex Got to Do with It, Marriage, Morality, and Rationality. As I read this article, I experienced a series of shudders of healing, as if not only my soul and mind, but also my very body, were finally able to shed a tremendous weight. Your combination of faith and reason, body and soul, have been invaluable tools for extricating myself from what has been a suffocating discourse of sex and gender introduced to me here. This student was discovering something along the lines that Professor George described the late historian Elizabeth Fox Genovese discovering in the afterword to her book, Marriage, The Dream That Refuses to Die, published in 2008. Quote, at the heart of her doubts about secular liberalism and what she described as radical upscale feminism was its embrace of abortion and its continuing dalliance with euthanasia. Betsy knew that the public pro-life advocacy would be regarded by many in the intellectual establishment as intolerable apostasy, especially from one of the founding mothers of women's studies. She could have been forgiven for keeping mum, but keeping mum about fundamental matters of right and wrong was not in her character, and thought she valued her standing in the intellectual world more than she valued her standing in the intellectual world. She cared for truth and justice. The article that the University of Chicago student wrote about, you recall that she said suffocating, is found in an important volume that Professor George and Professor Elstein edited, The Meaning of Marriage, in 2006. And there is a trend. Since entering the new century, Professor George has attempted, it seems to me, more than at any time in his career, to communicate with the broader public. A key book in this regard is The Clash of Orthodoxies, Law, Religion, and Morality in Crisis, published in 2001. This book, based on many of his major works of scholarship, also shows that Professor George has been interested to speak to his fellow Catholics, whether it be through articles in legal journals on Catholic moral philosophy, or to those of his co-religionists, some confused, it seems, by those intent on liberating their politics from inconvenient teachings of the church, such as on abortion, as All of us saw on national television the current Speaker of the House recently attempted to do. Others, it seems, want to remake the Catholic Church so that it will accommodate their own behavior. Thus, when Andrew Sullivan, who views himself as a Catholic and a conservative, proclaims spirituality in anonymous sex, his words, that is, quote, sexual relations with strangers, Professor George begins his review of Sullivan's book with this stanza from the lyrics of Chris Christopherson, quote, he's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction, taking every wrong direction on his lonely way back home, unquote. Yet, there is sensitivity in this review. Although Professor George's scholarship was a major target of Sullivan's book, and he got it factually wrong, by the way, and confused Professor George's own research with that of someone else's, Professor George's review, and I write this after I read from cover to cover Mr. Sullivan's book, is remarkably restrained. This is the kind of generosity of spirit, once fallacious arguments are refuted and the record is set straight, that Robert P. George shows, even when in some minds a devastating counterattack could have been launched. I found the full lyrics of the Christopherson piece that Professor George quoted, and this line helped me perhaps to understand a little bit better his view to an opponent such as perhaps Mr. Sullivan. And searching for a shrine, he's never found. He allows that maybe Mr. Andrew Sullivan, even in the critiquing of Professor George's position, might somehow, in his own way, be still trying to search, find something. I think that's a great generosity of spirit. This generosity of spirit also underlies Professor George's efforts to bring together Catholics and Protestants, as well as Jews, in a spirit of cooperation when it comes to the most important social issues of our day, such as abortion, same-sex marriage, or the status of the embryo. Only last month, in reviewing the history of the pro-life movement, he wrote, quote, at a decisive moment, the evangelical community became fully activated in the cause. Today, a common commitment to defending the unborn is at the heart of an unprecedented Catholic evangelical alliance that extends beyond abortion to issues of sexuality and marriage, education, welfare, crime and prison policy, international human rights and the place of religion in American public life. Great evangelical leaders such as James Dobson and Charles Colson stand arm in arm with their Catholic brothers and sisters in defending the right to life of every human being, irrespective not only of race, sex, and ethnicity, but also of age, size, stage of development, and condition of dependency. If this alliance that stands in the gap today in the fight against, it is this alliance that stands in the gap today in the fight against cloning and embryo-destructive biomedical research. He does not take it lightly when his evangelical friends are sideswiped. Quote from the Weekly Standard 2006, Charles Colson and his group have done this country and many thousands of imprisoned souls a great but largely unheralded service these 30 years. They do it not for praise, but it still smarts when a federal judge kicks them in the hindquarters for their effort. Unquote. 35 years ago, he writes, when the Lord conscripted a tough, aggressive ex-Marine into his service, little did the nation and the world know what was about to be unleashed on them. You've heard of a force of nature? Chuck Colson is a force of the supernatural. Like the late Mother Teresa of Calcutta, Chuck Colson has desired nothing more than to be an instrument in God's hands, bringing his love, forgiveness, and healing to a broken world. And what amazing use of this extraordinary man the Lord has made. Chuck Colson has brought unprecedented hope to prisoners and those caught up in the nightmarish world of drugs, prostitution, and violence. He has inspired thousands of us to stand up for the unborn child and to defend the institution of marriage and the family. He has been a leader in the fight for religious freedom and other human rights at home and abroad. In everything he does, he provides an unparalleled example of Christian discipleship. May the Lord, who has made Chuck Colson such a blessing for us, continue to bless him. This embrace of people of goodwill and faith has also extended to my own community, to the Mormon community. Some have wondered whether Mormons should or even can be invited to participate on the front line of this coalition. Robert P. George has been a steadfast supporter that we can work together. The recent vote over Proposition 8, in which members of all of the above-named faiths exercised their constitutional right to express their political views, was one example of just such cooperation and the expression of solidarity from Dr. James Dobson and so many other evangelicals when some took it upon themselves, as Dr. Dobson called it, to single out and attack members of the Mormon Church. That kind of solidarity was greatly received. May it be a harbinger of good things to come. The turn of the century also marked the arrival of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions in the Department of Politics at Princeton University. Professor George is the director, executive director of the program and its founder. The program sponsors several initiatives dedicated to exploring the enduring questions of American constitutional law and Western political thought. This aim, of course, grows out of Professor George's profound respect for the Constitution of the United States of America and the writings of the founders, particularly in relation to religious freedom, a topic of several of his major law articles. The James Madison Program offers the opportunity for scholars from around the country to be visiting fellows, as I was and as I know at least a few of you here were, to participate and contribute to the intellectual life of Princeton University and to conduct our own research. The program also hosts and co-sponsors a rich variety of lectures, symposias, and conferences to fulfill its aim, as well as invites its undergraduate fellows to meet and learn with the visiting fellows. One of Princeton's great mottos is Princeton University in the nation's service. The James Madison program is in the nation's service. It's remarkable to see there's almost a kind of national calendar that the program represents. As the year goes by, we don't forget the Constitution. We don't forget Lincoln, Washington, Madison. Speakers are invited from the entire political spectrum to be able to come to Princeton and share their views. It is indeed a program in the nation's service. In a recent article in the American Spectator, I found what I believe to be Professor George's most complete statement to date on the meaning of the liberal arts. Because we're at a university, and because I read something by President Dockery in which he stated, quote, "The purpose of Union University is to enable students to be grounded in the world of literature, values, ideals, history, ethics, arts, music, communication, and creativity, and of course, to be grounded in Christ." A very important question must be asked. What is the purpose of liberal arts learning? Professor George answers this question in this article. He holds that traditional texts, intellectual treasures of our civilization, such as the Bible, Dante, Chaucer, Shakespeare, many others, are viewed as mere works of propaganda on behalf of unjust, racist, sexist, classist, homophobic social orders, and that these sometimes at the university, these texts are co-opted as tools to subvert the modern forms of social injustice. Beyond this, however, he argues that liberal arts learning is meant to enable students to become truly authentic individuals, people who are true to themselves. But what is the self to which the authentic person is true? For those in the grip of the new liberationist ideology, to be true to oneself, he says, is to act on one's desires. People are defined by their desires. Authenticity consists in doing what you really want to do, in defiance, if necessary, of expectations based on putatively outmoded moral ideas and social norms. I think this is the true thump of this piece, the pièce de résistance. According to this conception, which Professor George labels a revisionist conception of liberal arts learning, now his words, whatever impedes you from doing what you truly want to do, unless that is what you want to do is in violation of some norm of political correctness, is a mere hang-up, something that holds you back from being the person you truly are. Such impediments, be they religious convictions, moral ideals, or what have you, are to be transcended for the sake of the free and full development of your personality. The essence of liberation is transcending such hang-ups, for example, by coming out as a homosexual, transvestite, polyamorist, or as a member of some other sexual minority, and acting on sexual desires that might have been repressed as a result of religious and moral convictions. He recognizes the confusion that can occur. Some people say liberal arts education is about shaking people up and getting the students out of their comfort zones. But he says, do not be confused. The classical is similar in conception. Both are meant, both proposed to be liberating, both promise to enable the student to achieve a greater measure of personal authenticity, but in substance they could not be farther apart. They are polar opposites. The classical understanding of the goal of liberal arts learning is not to liberate us, to act on our desires, but rather, and precisely, to liberate us from slavery to them. Personal authenticity, under the traditional account, consists in self-mastery, in placing reason in control of desire. According to the classical liberal arts ideal, he says, learning promises liberation, but it is not liberation from demeaning moral ideals and social norms. It is rather liberation from slavery to self. Just as he had done 15 years ago in making men moral, Professor George here challenges the Humean model of human nature, but in an applied context and one that reminds us of the central tradition. Just in closing, a couple of other things that he's done. Last week, we celebrated President's Week as well as President Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday. In Making Men Moral, this is how he understood part of the Lincoln-Douglas debate. Quote, Judge Douglas says he don't care whether slavery is voted up or down, but he cannot thus argue. Lincoln says, if he sees anything wrong in it, he cannot say that he would as soon see a wrong voted up as voted down. When Judge Douglas says that whoever or whatever community wants slaves, they have a right to have them, he is perfectly logical if there is nothing wrong in the institution. But if you admit that it is wrong, he cannot logically say that anybody has a right to do a wrong, unquote. Professor George's interpretation, Lincoln's claim against the proposition that someone could have a right to do wrong was that it was illogical. He alleged that Douglas implicitly contradicted himself in holding that slavery is wrong and communities have a right to establish or maintain the institution of slavery. He moves seamlessly from making men moral, just cue that last audio bit up for a second, to a public sphere in which he communicates with millions of Americans. And what's impressive about this movement, so there you just heard the interpretation in the Making Men Moral book, 15 years later, so just recently, I think it was November 2008, gave a public interview, and in it, you see he makes a similar argument, but expecting the audience to understand it, not having to dumb it down. Sure, there's not the technical language there, but believing that reason can guide us, all of us, to truth and to understanding. Do we have that?
Give your thesis on pro-choice and how it's a ridiculous phrase.
Well, it's a mistaken label because it pushes off stage the real issue that determines where a person stands on the question of abortion, and that is the legitimacy of the choice. If abortion is, as I believe it is, and as I believe you can prove it is very easily as a matter of scientific fact, the intentional killing of a living human being, a member of our species, one of our tiny brothers and sisters, then if you believe that that killing is a legitimate choice, whether you call yourself pro-choice or not, you are favoring abortion. You're favoring the legitimacy of abortion. It's a legitimate choice. It's not an injustice. If you're on the other side, on the pro-life side, then of course you're opposed to abortion. So it's not a question of choice. It's a question of whether we think the action is killing an innocent person, is a grave injustice, is an illegitimate choice or not. If you think it's legitimate, then you're for it. If not, you're against it. Compare it with slavery. Just take another example, another moral issue. Compare it with slavery. There were plenty of people.
And so he goes on and he introduces the same argument from the Making Men Moral, but to an audience of millions. He believes that we can understand, that reason can teach us. Recently, last year, and this is the summation here, he's published a couple of other books going into embryonic stem cell research. Jean Bethke-Elstein wrote in First Things this month, in an interview for a British magazine during the summer of 2005, Peter Singer said that if he faced the quandary of saving from a raging fire either a mentally disabled child, an orphan child nobody wanted, or normal animals, he would save the animals. In Embryo, a book that Robert George co-authored with Chris Tollefson, published by Doubleday so that it would get out to as many readers as possible, begins with a story that is the polar opposite of that story. Young Noah Benton Markham's life was saved in the wake of Hurricane Katrina by a group of Illinois and Louisiana policemen in flat-bottomed boats. Noah was trapped along with 1,400 embryos in canisters of liquid nitrogen at a hospital. In this book, the authors make the positive case for the moral standing of the human embryo and argue that it is morally wrong and unjust to kill that embryo, even if the goal of the embryo killing is the advancement of science or the development of therapeutic products or treatments, the claims for which are often overstated and exaggerated. They debunk dualistic philosophical and theological dualistic approaches for the lay reader. In a book published in the same year by Cambridge University Press, designed for a scholarly audience, he continues with Patrick Lee, the co-author, along that line. The book is entitled Body-Self Dualism in Contemporary Ethics and Politics, and he brings the full weight of philosophical and theological arguments against dualism there. Let me just close by saying that in the formidable body of work, and I've only touched it, touched on it. There are many, many other places where you could go. One of my favorite areas is the an essay that he wrote defending Pope Pius XII in Ronald Rischlach's book, Hitler, the War, and the Pope. There's been a great defamation campaign out to do down this pope who did tremendous things for the people of Europe, Christians and Jews, and specifically for Jews. And this has somehow been turned around in the recent past decade or two, owing to a left-wing German who published a play that had no basis really in historical evidence or fact. He popped up there, which I didn't expect. He pops up in many, many other contexts. This is a person, in the title I alluded to it, who sees good work and does that good work. Ramesh Panunru wrote that Professor George is fond of this particular 19th century Quaker hymn revived by Pete Seeger in the 1960s. When tyrants tremble, sick with fear, and hear their death knell ringing, when friends rejoice, both far and near, how can I keep from singing? This is a hymn, of course, I think in modulating it to Professor George's level, to justice and a celebration of the human goods of friendship and right relationships that we find in Making Men Moral. Thank you.